You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. What is artificial intelligence? Will robots become our super intelligent overlords and supplant human life on Earth? What does AI do well, and where is it less competent than your pet hamster? We'll be talking about all of this with today's guest, who has a new book out called Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. Stay with us. Support for the Radio Cafe comes in part from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a reading and conversation by Nora Ericott with Janine Jackson on Wednesday, December 4th at 7 p.m. at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. Nora Ericott is a human rights attorney whose book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine, offers a new approach to understanding the Palestinian struggle for freedom told through the power and control of international law. Tickets available at the Lenzic or Lenzic.org or call 505-988-1234. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the Santa Fe Institute, a world-renowned research hub offering free online courses in the science of complex systems. Check out their community lecture series and summer science festival in Santa Fe. More at santafe.edu. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Melanie Mitchell. She's a professor of computer science at Portland State University. She's external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. And her new book is called Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. She will be speaking on Tuesday, the 12th of November at 7:30. It's a community lecture sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute at the Lenzic Center for Performing Arts. Welcome.
Oh, thanks. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. This is such a wonderfully written book. It's accessible to non-scientists, ordinary people, so thank you.
Well, thank you. Great to hear.
But let's start with some basics. The term artificial intelligence was coined in the 1950s. What does it mean? What's the difference between a computer that's doing AI and a computer that's doing non-intelligent activity?
Oh, that's a really good question. And it's hard to answer because the term artificial intelligence keeps changing its definition. It's never been very clearly defined. When people have different definitions, they say things like, well, getting computers to do intelligent things. But what does that mean exactly? To have intelligent behavior, to do things that require human intelligence. But we don't even know what human intelligence is. So what people often do is say, well, if it's something that we can't do with computers yet, but humans can do, we call it AI. And then when computers can do it, like playing chess or playing Go, we sometimes change the definition and say, well, that didn't really require that much intelligence because a computer can do it. So it's kind of a moving target.
So that is confusing. So so why don't we talk about some examples of how AI is being used today? Like, what are some examples in our daily lives and the infrastructure that we're surrounded by that is using AI?
There's more and more examples in our daily life. So one example that most people use is navigation, maps. So Google Maps will tell you, will figure out an optimal route for you to go from one place to another and do that almost instantaneously. And that's using AI. Another system that uses AI is Google Search. If you search the web and you type in some kind of query, it's analyzing your query using natural language processing systems, which are considered to be AI systems.
Natural language meaning
human,
what we are speaking.
Human language, right.
Right.
Speech recognition. If you ever dictate something like on your phone, dictate a text or an email, and it transcribes what you said, that's something I use all the time, and that's using the cutting-edge AI technology. Translation between languages, like machine translation programs like Google Translate, use AI systems. Facial recognition, which is now getting more deployed more and more for security purposes, such as in airports, in crime fighting, etc. That's AI.
Or your phone. Or some of the new phones.
Yeah, some of the new phones, or even any kind of search for images online, things like that. It's all over the place, really.
And there's a paradox that arises, which is very interesting, which is when you try to teach machines, computers, to learn things that we know how to do, what's hard for us is easy for them, and what's easy for us is hard for them. Explain that paradox.
Right. So computers are very good at things that are hard for us, like playing chess at a grandmaster level, or multiplying very large numbers very quickly. Sometimes the things that we find very challenging and we use computers to do, like figuring out an optimal route between two places and things like that. But the things that seem almost the easiest for us, just automatic, like walking around a room without bumping into anything, or looking at a photo and describing what's in the photo, or recognizing like dogs in real life and in pictures and on statues and things like that. Those things are hard for computers. Those things are still unsolved problems for computers. So people say that this paradox, Marvin Minsky coined this phrase saying easy things are hard.
Right.
In a way, these things that are so easy for us are almost invisible to us. We don't know how we do them. They just come very naturally. Or even having a conversation like we're having, that's something that no machine could really do.
Although they try. I mean, there's the famous Turing test.
Right. So the Turing test is proposed by Alan Turing in 1950 to try and determine whether a computer is intelligent or not by just saying, let's see if you, a human, can talk to a computer or a human, you don't know which it is, and it convinces you that it's a human, then we'll say that it's thinking. But the problem is that it seems like the Turing test is too easy to pass because we have all these programs called chat bots that will chat with people and have been quite successful at fooling people sometimes into thinking that they're actually other humans, even though they're very unsophisticated and they don't really understand anything you're saying. They're just using sort of template matching and very kind of simple tricks. But we're very easy to fool.
Unless you go deep.
Unless you go deep. Unless you go for more than a few minutes. Unless you really probe the chatbot. You can usually tell, but it takes some thought. It takes some doing. And I know there's been a lot of instances of people being fooled on like social media by bots that pretend to be humans and get them into conversations and find out personal information.
Right.
And people, people just are very trusting if something has any appearance of being understanding or thinking or conscious, and they believe that it is.
Well, we've had innumerable conversations with other people online and rarely, if ever, with bots that we know of. And so it's not even a category that most people have.
That's right. We don't think about it. So, but to really have an in-depth conversation, like the one we're having right now, no computer would be able to do that or come near to it now.
Well, that is a really important distinction. And it's the distinction between what they call general AI and, I guess, specific AI.
Like narrow AI.
Narrow AI, which is like the programs that can beat the reigning world champion in chess, you know. But that same AI program that can beat the chess master can't even play checkers. It can't do anything else. So, you know, virtually all the AI that you mentioned, you know, the maps, the navigation, the language translation, and so on, that's narrow AI. And it's great, you know, anyone who's ever had to do audio transcription, it's nice that there are machines that can do it. But the question that I keep thinking about, like, AI has become a vast field. And in AI, to what extent are you trying to, like, mimic and understand the way humans think, like human intelligence, to get computers to learn the way we learn and so on? And to what extent is it like using computers to achieve things, but not necessarily the way humans do it?
Yeah, so people do different things. AI is really an umbrella term for a lot of different computer methods, to achieve intelligent behavior, if you will. And one description of AI was that it's an anarchy of methods, which means that there's some people working on ways to mimic the human brain. There's some people working on ways to mimic sort of what psychologists have learned about the way children learn. There's some people who are just engineering systems that have nothing to do with the way people or animals work. They're just trying to get something to work well. And it really is kind of an anarchy, and nobody's found the exact right approach yet. And there's all kinds of different approaches. So it's a very wide open field. There are now one set of approaches that are kind of dominating the field, and those are called deep neural networks. And those are roughly inspired by the way the brain works, although they turn out to be quite different from the way the brain works. But those deep neural networks are powering most of the AI systems that are now being used in the real world.
And what's so interesting is that when they learn to do things, or when, you know, we program them to do things, problems are solved, but new problems are also created. So, like, keeping a system safe from being hacked, there's this amazing set of examples. And I remember seeing this online a while back. Like, there are image recognition programs where if you change a few pixels, the program can't recognize it, even though we can. So you have in your book, like, two pictures of a school bus and two pictures of a dog, and they look identical to the human viewer. But because a few pixels were strategically taken out, the image recognition program thinks that the school bus is an ostrich.
Yes. So this is one of the things people have discovered about these deep neural networks. These networks are very large programs. They're not as big as the brain, but they're pretty big. They have simulated neurons and simulated connections between neurons. And they're very complicated. They learn from data, but no one really understands exactly what they have learned. But they seem to have the right behavior, except that they can be fooled. So if you try to fool them using some clever techniques, they will get the wrong answer. And this isn't just in vision, like, you know, classifying a school bus or a stop sign or other kinds of visual data, but also in language such as speech or reading or other kinds of language processing. They can be fooled, and that's concerning to people who work in cybersecurity, because say we have a self-driving car, and its visual system has learned to recognize stop signs. Well, that's something you would very much like your self-driving car to recognize, but it turns out that you can modify the stop signs a little bit. People have shown this by putting stickers on them in these weird patterns, and that will fool some of these vision systems into thinking that it's a speed limit sign. So we really want to protect this kind of AI infrastructure from being hacked or fooled, but nobody knows general ways to do that, to protect these systems.
And the more that's at stake, the more dangerous those kinds of potential mistakes are. So, like, if a self-driving car doesn't stop at a stop sign, there can be an accident, people can be hurt or killed. Another example from your book was somebody took images of everybody in Congress and compared them to a database of people who'd committed crimes to see if there would be matches. And they matched, and it was wrong. And not only that, it was kind of racist, because more African-American members of Congress were identified as being matched with somebody in the criminal database.
Yeah, that's right. So that actually wasn't a hacking problem. That was just a problem with the facial recognition system getting wrong answers. And it's been shown that, unfortunately, these facial recognition systems, which are trained on lots and lots of faces, especially from online pictures, photographs, that these facial recognition systems are worse when the face has darker skin, and better when the face has lighter skin. And that may be, there's many possible reasons for that. One may be that the data that it learned from was biased, that it mostly learned from people with whiter skin.
Which may be who is uploading more pictures.
That's right. Who these data sets that have been collected to train these facial recognition systems probably are primarily white people and also primarily male. And it turns out these systems are worse on females than they are on males. This whole area of bias in AI systems, racial, gender, age, other kinds of bias that comes from bias in the data that they learn from is becoming very much central to the whole field. People are now waking up to this problem and saying, you know, this is going to be a real problem.
Yeah, I mean, if there's a facial recognition system that says you can't get on a plane because you've been matched with somebody in the criminal database and it's not true, I mean, for each one of these systems that might, on the one hand, save a lot of time, save a lot of money, there has to be some kind of like manual human override.
That's right. And that's something that I think most people in the field of AI would agree that these systems are not yet ready to be kind of autonomous and making decisions completely on their own. There has to be a human in the loop. But humans have their own biases. And we've seen some problems with humans, making decisions that involve bias. And it was hoped that, you know, algorithms might be less biased. So there's all these different trade-offs. You know, the algorithms don't have intrinsic bias that they, you know, but they just have their data that they've learned from. So there's a lot of people thinking about what's the best way to balance all these issues when deciding how autonomous these systems should be.
There's a lot of people who are concerned about artificial intelligence and not just, you know, hardcore Luddites. I mean, some people will say, and I'm now quoting from your book, but they'll say AI can virtually eliminate global poverty, massively reduce disease, and provide better education to almost everyone on the planet. But then other people are worried about losing jobs. You know, how many of their jobs are going to be automated away? We've already seen a lot of that in the Industrial Revolution. They're worried about erosion of privacy and civil rights due to AI surveillance, you know, sort of ubiquitous, big brotherish. And there's so many examples of that now, just your data being collected in so many different ways. Amoral autonomous weapons, unchecked decisions by opaque and untrustworthy computer programs, magnification, as we've talked about, of racial and gender bias, manipulation of the mass media, increase of cybercrime, and what one respondent, as you quoted, called true existential irrelevance for humans. Lots of worries. What are your own greatest concerns, and how is the field addressing them?
So I'll say that, you know, I think there's both sides are correct that AI is already providing a lot of benefits and has potential to provide amazing benefits. I just came back from a conference on AI in medicine, and it's amazing how much potential there is, especially for providing medical care to areas that have very little medical resources, you know.
How would it do that?
By being able to automate some of the diagnoses. You know, machines are getting very good at being able to, for instance, diagnose certain diseases by looking at images and getting data from patients. And in some diseases, the machines are doing almost as well as human physicians. So if that actually comes to pass, that we can get help, you know, with medical care, I mean, not to replace physicians, but to assist them and to kind of fill gaps, that would be a huge thing. That would be huge in the field of medicine and healthcare. But the other side is, and that's just one example of a benefit. But the other side is also true. These systems can be misused or can be used for things like surveillance, as is happening in some countries now. AI systems are being increasingly used to keep control of the population. These systems are also, the military is getting more and more interested in autonomous systems for warfare. We already have drones and all of that. There's a lot of ethical issues that the field is grappling with. And of course, you know, people who are researchers in the field, none of us studied moral philosophy. We did computer science or math or something like that. So we're not really well trained to think about a lot of these issues. So I think it's great that a lot of people from different perspectives are getting involved in this. And
what does that look like? I mean, there are some institutions that have been set up specifically to address AI ethical issues.
There's been quite a few ethics and AI institutes, and also within AI companies, ethics panels are being set up. So like the big AI companies like Google and Facebook and so on are setting up their own ethics panels. You know, whether or not you can trust that is another story, but at least they're saying that they want to address these problems.
Why does that not give me a sense of reassurance?
Well, I think Google in particular had an ethics panel that they had to disband.
After like a week or
something.
Yeah,
you heard about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they've had some problems dealing with this kind of thing. And the, you know, it's, I think it's going to be hard for corporations who have, you know, they have their shareholders and they want to have returns on their, you know, they make want to make profits and so on, to balance that with ethical issues. And that's not just true in AI, that's true throughout the corporate world. But for instance, at this medical conference, several of the speakers were people in philosophy who studied ethics, and had, and also some lawyers who were interested in legal aspects of AI in medicine in particular. And they're now all focusing on AI as their topic from the point of view of philosophy, law, medicine, sociology. And I think that's really important for the field, that a large spectrum of thinkers get involved and really think about these issues, because none of us know exactly what to do about it.
Can AI be regulated? Should it be regulated? And if so, how would that happen?
So, should it be regulated? Probably. It's always hard to know exactly how much regulation there should be. You know, you don't want to sort of stifle research. At the same time, I think there's the potential for AI systems to be misused is high enough that we should have some regulation. Who should do the regulating? Well, it's hard. That's also hard, right? I mean, I think a good model for this is the field of sort of synthetic biology or genetic engineering. They're also kind of struggling with how to regulate these new technologies that affect living systems. And AI has some parallels to that.
Are you talking to each other?
Not as much as we should be. I think that's something that really, I think probably some people are, but that's definitely something that should be a broader conversation. Can it be? That's a hard one, because just like in all these other technologies, we have all these different countries that are pursuing AI.
Right.
China, for instance, is pursuing AI. They're pouring a huge amount of money and resources into AI, and their government might have a different set of values for thinking about the ethics of certain technologies than like the US or Canada or Europe.
But we're all involved in using a lot of the same systems.
Right. So it's a global problem. And as you know, it's hard to get global agreement on anything. You know, we had the issue of, you know, nuclear weapons that we had to deal with globally. And at least we haven't had a nuclear war since World War II. AI, on the other hand, you know, everybody is pursuing it and probably is going to be employing it not only as sort of for government control purposes, but also for military purposes. And so it's definitely worrisome, and I'm not sure how we're going to get global agreement on how to control it or regulate it.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We'll be back in just a moment. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is once again accepting scholarship applications, and Northern New Mexico residents are invited to apply. Deadline for undergraduate scholarships is the 21st of January, 2020. Deadline for Career Pathways Scholarships in support of two-year degrees, certificates, and trades is November 17th, 2019. Criteria and application for both may be found at lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. I mean, there's a kind of follow the money thing with this, it seems to me. Like, you know, we're told with every innovation that, I mean, remember, nuclear energy is going to be too cheap to meter, or labor-saving devices are going to mean the 20-hour work week, and these things never come about. So, you know, oh, AI is going to eradicate global poverty and help with inequality and democratization and so on. But, like, when I read your book, I'm seeing money put into things like natural language processing, speech recognition, so the companies can automatically read customer reviews so that they can make better advertising to sell more products or create better political ads. And that just seems like business as usual. I mean, trying to influence the masses to buy stuff or vote for someone. And there's no sense of building democracy or solving our real problems.
Yeah. So I think that for some, a lot of people in the field, the goal is to, you know, use AI for social good. And there's definitely some, a lot of people working on various aspects of that. But as you pointed out, these companies, the bottom line is there, they have to make money. And the way that they make money is by using data about their users or data about everyone to try and promote products, influence people to do things. And, you know, the incentives are not there for these companies to really use these products for social benefits. So it is business as usual. I don't think it's any different. You know, I think that the people who worry about, who sort of say AI is going to solve all of our problems, it's going to solve the climate problem, it's going to solve overpopulation, it's going to, you know, solve the food crisis and everything, they're way over optimistic. On the other hand, I think the people who say that, you know, we're going to have super intelligent robots that take over and enslave us are also completely wrong. That's, you know, way more advanced than AI is right now.
Well, one of the things, I just talked to a man named Thomas Malone at MIT who wrote a book called Superminds. And one of the things he said in his book was that for decades, everybody's been saying that, or some people have been saying that general AI, like AI becoming as smart as we are, is about 20 years away. Yeah. And they might have been saying that in 1960.
They were.
And 1980.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's always been 15 to 20 years away.
Right. And it hasn't happened. And I keep thinking about, like, if the goal of, or one of the goals of AI is to make machines that are as smart as we are, like, why? Why would anyone want to do that?
I think originally the field started as more of a scientific enterprise that said, we want to understand what intelligence is. You know, we know that humans are intelligent, at least, you know, in a certain way, and animals are intelligent, and we want to understand this thing, that this property of nature that's called intelligence, and we're going to do it by building computer systems to be intelligent, and that's going to help us understand nature. That's why I got in the field. That was my interest. But I think the field has kind of split into people who are interested in more the intellectual aspects of intelligence and people who are more interested in the applications engineering aspect of AI. And the former, I think the original goal of making machines as smart as people, everybody in AI sort of has that goal, but, you know, most people tend to work on very narrow areas. To me, you know, and you're saying, like, why would we want to do that? Well, one reason beyond just understanding intelligence would be, there's a question in my mind that if machines are not as smart as we are we able to trust them? So if we really want to have autonomous cars or other kinds of autonomous systems, if they don't have the intelligence that we have, are they going to be able to deal with the kind of situations that we deal with all the time? And to me, that's a very big question. I'm not sure that they will.
Right. Well, and I mean, I guess, you know, you could say, do we really need self-driving cars in the first place? That's maybe another question. But I mean, the idea that AI can mimic human intelligence raises for me a lot of questions about what, I don't know if this term exists, but I was like thinking to myself about cognitive biodiversity. Like, there are so many different people with so many different kinds of intelligence. Nobody has every kind. You know, I talk to so many different kinds of people, like, just doing this show. But, you know, you think about musical intelligence, political, visual, logical, legal, emotional, kinesthetic, storytelling. I mean, storytelling is one of the most fundamental forms of kind of human cognition. And, you know, it's how we understand things. And you know, and then different cultures cultivate and value different kinds of intelligence. And so, and then there's like, I was thinking about mental illness and trauma and things that can be, you know, the source of creativity. They can be how we grow, how we eventually become smarter. And so when you talk about like, we're going to learn how the human brain works. Well, there's 7 billion different human brains and they all work differently. And although we have things in common, that diversity is vast.
That's a good point. So I think what you just said shows that intelligence is a very ill-defined concept. And Marvin Minsky called intelligence a suitcase word, which means a word in which many, many meanings are stuffed in together. And in some ways, it's not a very useful word because it's too over, it's overstuffed with different meanings. And it's one of those words that I think of as a placeholder for something that we want to understand, but we don't really understand yet. And when we understand it better, we'll come up with a better set of words to describe it. And so all these different kinds of intelligences that you talk about are aspects of our humanity that come about through our bodies and our brain. And I think what, on the scientific side of AI, the goal is to really try and understand how that happens, like why that happens and how certain behaviors come about. On the engineering side of AI, it's more like, well, there's certain behaviors that are really useful in the real world, like being able to stack boxes in a warehouse or being able to converse with somebody on a consumer helpline or something like that. And so they want to focus on those. Now, I think you're right that we're all very different in our intelligences, but compared to machines, there's something that we all have very much in common. Certain set of abilities.
Like abilities, as you said before, to recognize a dog.
Yeah, we all have this these basic abilities that come from, we have the same kind of bodies. We all have eyes. We all have, you know, ears. We all see in basically the same way. Our language essentially works in the same way, even if we speak different languages. We can communicate with people from different cultures because there's this commonality. So I think that there, you know, intelligence is a complicated thing. It's a very complex system, if you will. And that's part of why I got interested in this whole field, is to try and understand what are we talking about?
Well, I mean, a lot of the things that you're talking about are not just human attributes. I mean, dogs can recognize faces and they can walk around the room without bumping into things. So it's really a kind of almost like a type of life intelligence or biological or animal intelligence,
yeah,
in some ways.
Yeah. I think it's the intelligence that any evolved system would have in its environment to be able to cope with the world and survive and thrive, you know, in some way.
Okay. So AI seems to be focused on sight and sound primarily, but there's also three other senses, you know, touch, taste, and smell. Are you looking at those? Do they factor in at all to AI?
So Much less so. So the main areas of AI are like in vision, audition, you know, with like speech recognition, music, or sound recognition, and language is very big, written and spoken, and also movement, like robots.
Right.
And for robots, sort of touch is important, you know, to be able to manipulate objects and deal with objects. The other senses, like smell and taste, people haven't paid much attention to them in AI because they're not really seen, I guess, as a big part of like what makes us intelligent. Whether that's true or not, you know, certainly smell is important for dogs and other animals.
It's important for us too. I don't know, like, again, the word intelligence, what does it mean? It's such a big part of our cognition, right? It's part of our memory. Like, mm-hmm. You smell something and it sets off a whole chain of thoughts and memories for people. And so I just found myself wondering, like, this question of, you know, the singularity will soon be here, and maybe our robot overlords will take over, or maybe not. But it seems to me like, as a person outside of all this, it would be wonderful if AI could do all the boring stuff and leave human beings to do what we do best.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why? I mean, there are people who are having computers try to compose poetry or music or things like that. And it's mm-hmm. sort of like maybe an academic game, but those are things that, you know, it'd be nice to just give us that time to be the creative beings that we are.
So you're saying that you think AI researchers should not try and work on certain things, like...
I don't know, but just like this whole question of make, quote unquote, because it comes up over and over again in so many different places, they will be as smart as we are. Well, I mean, if you think about what we do best, so much of it has to do with embodiment. It has to do with being conscious, breathing, water-based beings who evolved over the course of millions of years and who are interested in food and survival and curing illness and mortality and things that computers will never know.
Well, I don't know if computers will never know them. I think, you know, what one of the things we found is that our definition of computer is also, in a way, incomplete. That what we think of as computers has changed and will change.
What do you mean?
Well, initially, the origination of the word computer used to be people who computed things, people who did calculations.
And it was mostly women.
During World War II, it was mostly women who were called computers. And then electronic computers were created. And they were big, giant boxes. But now people are looking at computation as something that goes beyond any particular kind of hardware. And so people talk about DNA computation. We can do computations using DNA. We look at certain kinds of animals and say they're doing certain kinds of computations. And this notion of computation, of what constitutes a computation, is sort of goes beyond these machines that we now call computers. And when you say computers will never do this, I think, you know, well, maybe we'll have a different notion of what a computer is. And maybe we can give a computer a body, like a robot, but it has a kind of body and it can actually touch things and it has some kind of simulated nervous system. You know, there's all kinds of philosophical sort of thought experiments you can do to try and probe these ideas. You know, but I think we shouldn't limit ourselves to saying what computers can never do.
I had a conversation recently with Nicholas Carr, who wrote this book called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brain. He's written mm-hmm. a number of books since then. But it was a wonderful book. And one of the things that he questioned was whether computation or whether the computer is the right metaphor for the mind. It's a metaphor. It has some power. But is it the best one? is there an organic metaphor, you know, a sort of plant-based metaphor with new shoots coming out and leaves dying off and roots rerooting and things like that?
Yeah, everybody has different metaphors for thinking about the mind, the brain and the mind, and that's because we don't understand it.
Well, what kind of conversations are there, like, in the AI community, like, for those models and metaphors, besides computers?
Oh, people talk about dynamical systems. It's another kind of metaphor framework that is systems like, how to say this, more like physics kinds of metaphors, like, you know, balls rolling down slopes,
right,
and coming into coming to rest and coming into equilibrium. And you can think of the brain as being all these different balls running down all these different slopes and coming into some kind of equilibrium, and that equilibrium is like a thought. There's all kinds of interesting, strange ways people think about it, but thinking about it as computation has actually been pretty helpful in helping people kind of get a handle on what the brain is doing, but it might not be the only way for understanding it. You know, an AI this will sound strange, but it may be that AI itself doesn't have to necessarily be focused on computation of the way we think about it now. One of the questions I get all the time is, like, quantum computation, is that going to affect AI? And quantum computation is a very different kind of computation than our current computers do. But maybe that kind of approach is going to be the approach for thinking about the mind and intelligence. But I don't know. It's a really interesting time to be working in this area.
Well, you just wrote this book, and you're going to be at SFI in the coming year or so. What are you working on? What are your hopes to sort of be part of the advancement of this field?
So for me, I want to make the conversations about AI more interdisciplinary, which is the reason I wanted to come to the Santa Fe Institute, which is focused on interdisciplinary approaches to science. And I've seen that leaving thoughts of thinking about AI to computer scientists gets us pretty stuck in a lot of these different areas, not only thinking about what is intelligence, but also thinking about the ethical questions, sort of what the goals of the field should be, all of that. So we really need a much broader set of people talking about these things. And I'm hoping that that's something I can help facilitate being at SFI, is to get people thinking quite broadly about intelligence, and not just people who are now AI researchers who are primarily computer scientists, but also people in philosophy, in sociology, right, in ethics, in cognitive science, in neuroscience, so on.
I couldn't help wondering, and, you know, no disrespect to anybody, but it seems to me that computer science may have somewhat of an overrepresentation of people on the spectrum, sort of on the autism spectrum, and whether that influences how people are seeing and defining what intelligence is.
So I don't know if anybody's ever looked at that. I know that's a stereotype, but I'm not sure if it's really true. I think that computer science is it's becoming a more and more diverse field, fortunately. It has been in the past primarily male, primarily white, but I think it's a lot more women, a lot more people of color, and people from different cultures are coming into the field, which is changing the way people think about some of these issues.
What are some of the ways that is changing the way people are thinking about these issues?
So I don't know if I can say, I mean, I can give you some impressions that I have. I don't know if these are really true, but I feel like in the past, the vision of AI, the dominant vision of AI, is kind of like this brain in a vat, right? It doesn't have a body. It doesn't interact with anybody. It's just thinking. It's like pure thought. Whereas now people are thinking more about intelligence as being this kind of social phenomenon, this interactive phenomenon, that you can't have an isolated brain that's you know, gets input and then spits out output. It's much more a continuous interactive process that involves multiple individuals, multiple entities. And I feel like that's come from having a more diverse group of people in the field, thinking sort of that shift. Another shift is I've noticed, like with my students, when I'm teaching computer science, that in the old days, most of my students were male, and they got into computer science because they enjoyed playing video games when they were kids, or even still in college, and they wanted to build video games, and they were really excited about AI because they thought it could make video games smarter. But when more women are in the field, that focus has changed some, and sort of that focus on sort of interacting with computers in this game way is changing a little bit to more like interacting with them in more of a human-like way, wanting to converse with them, wanting them to help us rather than to kind of compete with us or to, you know.
Talk about gender stereotypes. It's so funny.
I know, but that's why I said it's an impression.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an impression I have. And, you know, gender stereotypes are terrible. I hate them. But at the same time, stereotypes often have some validity, at least in gender, I've seen that, you know, I find in general that the male students I interact with, this is like a total, this is more on average than individuals, but are more focused on competition, and the female students tend to be more focused on collaboration. So now I'm going to get killed for saying that.
But do not kill Melanie Mitchell, ladies and gentlemen. She's talking about things where there is, in fact, a lot of data behind what you're saying.
Yeah. But I think when there's a group, like a mixed group, a diverse group, that, you know, people influence other people, and, yeah, you know, everybody kind of broadens their own perspective a little bit. So it's like the males become more female-like and the females become a little bit more male-like. And it's a good thing.
A greater diversity of topics is addressed and a greater diversity of questions. And I think this is really one of the central questions is, how do you decide and who decides what problems are going to be addressed by AI?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And so there's a really interesting article some years ago by George Packer in The New Yorker about how a lot of the apps that are made in Silicon Valley are made by 25-year-olds to solve 25-year-olds' problems.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, in fact, that's something that people pointed out, that, you know, there's a lot of attention paid to gender bias and racial bias, but there's also a great kind of age bias in the field, in all of technology. And part of that is because the technology companies are so disproportionately young and don't hire older people and therefore don't really know what the concerns of different generations are.
And if they did that, it might broaden the scope of what they're doing and thinking about with respect to AI.
I think so. Absolutely.
Melanie Mitchell is a professor of computer science at Portland State University. Her new book is called Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. She will be speaking about the book and about this whole set of things and much more that we've been talking about on Tuesday, November 12th at 7:30 in the evening, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. It's at the Lenzick Center for Performing Arts right here in Santa Fe. It's free and open to the public. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And the Radio Cafe, once again, would like to thank its generous sponsors, the Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation, the Lenzick Performing Arts Center, the Santa Fe Institute, the Lannan Foundation, and Southwest Care. Thank you all so much for making this program possible. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood support and partnerships, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks Lannan Foundation for their sponsorship of this program.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.